Welcome to today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, April 13th, 2025. This program was previously broadcast on October 6th, 2024. We open with two articles from Advances in the September 2024 issue of Scientific American. First, Phantom Costs, Why Too Good to Be True Scares People Off, from the Department of Psychology. If a stranger offered you a free cookie, you might well eat it. But what if they offered to also give you $2? You might politely decline and walk away thinking, something smells fishy. In a study published in the journal Personality and Social Psychology Bulletin, researchers found that people tend to turn down offers of free money, as well as unusually high salaries or suspiciously cheap services, because they seem too good to be true. The research bridges economics and psychology to explain why financial incentives backfire. In the initial experiment, nearly 40% of participants ate a cookie offered freely, compared with about 20% of those offered $2 as well. People typically imagine things like someone did something disgusting to the cookie, says study lead author Andrew J. Wanish, a psychological scientist at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand. Nine further experiments involving more than 4,000 participants used online questionnaires to present other scenarios. These included being offered money to accept a ride home, outrageously high construction job wages, and surprisingly cheap flights. In each case, past a certain threshold, higher potential monetary gain reduced participants' likelihood of accepting the offer. Vanish says the study illustrates that contrary to the standard economic model, which supposes humans always seek to maximize gains, transactions need to also be understood as social interactions between people trying to understand each other's minds. If someone seems to violate accepted norms, such as self-interest, without any explanation, we assume they have hidden motives and infer there will be phantom costs, imagined consequences that reduce what Vanish calls an offer's psychological value. Factors beyond the present moment may come into play. Understanding that others' perceived overgenerosity may put us in their debt could also help explain people's reluctance, says Rachel McCloy, a psychologist studying decision-making at England's University of Reading. The old maxim, "there's no such thing as a free lunch," is clearly alive and well. Another experiment found that high scores on measures of distrust inferred more phantom costs. The researchers also showed how to mitigate the effect, simply provide a reason for the deal. The cheap flights experiment included a condition where the seats were revealed to be very uncomfortable. Uncomfortable seats aren't typically a selling point, Vanish says, but telling people the seats were uncomfortable made them more willing to take them because it was sufficient explanation. The scientists are now experimenting with whether phantom costs play into humans' interactions with robots and artificial intelligence. If AI is overly generous, will people imagine phantom costs? Vanish says. People tend to anthropomorphize and treat AI agents as if they have a mind, when obviously they don't. This article posted by Simon Macken. Next, from the Department of Geology, Frozen Underworld. A new map shows a complex landscape below Greenland's ice. Scientists have been trying for decades to uncover the true geology of Greenland, an island one-third the size of Australia and almost entirely concealed under mile-deep ice sheets. For a recent study in the journal Geophysical Research Letters, scientists constructed a new map that suggests geological details and dramatic terrain hidden underneath the ice. A lot of people think of Greenland's landmass as being a big, rigid plate that moves all the same, says study co-author William Colgan, a glaciologist at the Geological Survey of Denmark and Greenland. but it may not be uniform, and understanding how individual geological features might shift and twist below the ice can help improve GPS accuracy for scientific studies and mineral exploration. Mapping Greenland's true geology can also help predict ice sheet stability, because young volcanic bedrock transforms more geothermal heat to ice sheets than older rocks do. Researchers drew today's widely accepted geological map of Greenland in 2009, largely based on exposed rock along the island's coasts. That approach might work for a smaller, narrower landmass, but not in northern Greenland, where the coasts are more than 500 miles apart and could have dramatic geological variation in between. If you took North America, put an enormous ice sheet on top of it, and were handed the geology of New York, Maryland, or California, and asked to determine the geology of Nebraska, you would have a hard time making an accurate guess, says Pennsylvania State University geoscientist Sridhar Anandakrishnan. Since 2009, a burst of new satellites, radar systems, and seismic stations has prompted steady growth in datasets available for geological mapping, the researchers say. For their new Greenland map, Colligan and his team processed the available data on changes in gravity, magnetism, crust thickness, bedrock terrain, seismic wave transmission, and ice surface features across the landmass. Experts analyzed each collection of measurements and noted boundaries between areas with significant variation. The overlap of these boundaries suggests that Greenland's ice conceals three previously unidentified geological regions, or provinces, each with distinctive characteristics. One, for instance, seems volcanic in origin and relatively young. Another has rough terrain that could come from extensive hills and valleys. The researchers also spotted thousands of ice surface features that most likely indicate subglacial valleys, many of them hundreds of miles long and running parallel to one another. And they noticed that ice streams flow faster at the boundaries between some geological regions, suggesting the streams erode those regions in distinct ways. Measurements along some boundary lines were left to the experts' best guesses, but survey data keep coming in, and Colligan is optimistic next time his team works on this type of map. He hopes to have larger data sets and better artificial intelligence analytical tools. This article posted by Sogat Balaki. Both of these articles appear in the September 2024 issue of Scientific American. Next, in the same issue, from the column Mind Matters, edited by Daisy Juhas, no spoilers, please. Curiosity makes people hungry for knowledge, but not always in a hurry. Ask any birder, and they'll tell you about the thrill of identifying a new species. Recently, a tapping sound outside a window alerted one of us authors to the presence of a striking, unfamiliar woodpecker in a nearby tree. Woodpeckers are fairly common in this neighborhood in the southeastern U.S., but this one looked different. Its head was plumed with large red feathers, and it was huge, the size of a crow. Curious, she whipped out a phone app and soon became acquainted with the pileated woodpecker. And by the way, the part of the southeastern U.S. this is in is around Duke University in northern North Carolina. Scientists have often seen curiosity as motivation to discover new information and to initiate and facilitate learning. That framing suggests that curiosity is all about acting now, that it drives us to find answers as soon as possible. In previous research, when people were able to choose whether to receive their highly anticipated answer to a question now or later, they generally opted for the fastest path to resolution. This impatience for answers aligns with what psychologists think is a main function of curiosity: to reduce uncertainty. The state of not knowing or of recognizing a gap in your knowledge can be discomforting, like an itch that needs to be scratched. This feeling of uncertainty then motivates a search for information that, when obtained, is met with relief and satisfaction. But this picture of curiosity is incomplete. Consider how people watch a murder mystery movie. As the tension builds, viewers want to know the identity and the motive of the murderer. But unlike the desire to identify a strange new bird, most don't feel the urge to reach for a phone and resolve that curiosity. Instead, people savor the twists and turns of the plot as they gather more information. The desire to avoid premature resolution is so common that viewers explicitly label details in online conversations with spoiler alerts to help one another preserve uncertainty. In a study published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, USA, we explored whether there are multiple flavors of curiosity. We found that although piquing interest can indeed drive an urgent desire for answers, it can also elicit more patience, setting people up for those moments of discovery. We asked more than 2,000 people aged 19 to 76 years to watch a series of short videos that we created for an online experiment. Each video started with a blank screen. A line would then appear and squiggle around, gradually taking a shape. Imagine, for example, an animated line that begins to wiggle upward and downward, tracing a series of triangles reminiscent of a crown or mountain range. The line then extends, forming an oval around the triangles, resembling an Easter egg. Then, just as you start to feel certain you know what the finished drawing will be, long, pointy spikes are sketched at the top, revealing the true subject, a pineapple. While our study participants watched each video, we asked them to report how curious they were about what the drawing would become and to guess what the drawing was going to turn into. They also told us on a scale of 1 to 100, from least to most, how confident they felt about their prediction and how much joy or frustration they felt. Those replies let us gauge how curiosity changed as people saw more of a video. We also gave them the choice to either keep watching the drawing slowly unfold or jump to the end of the video, revealing the entire picture immediately. Interestingly, when participants were more curious about what the drawing would become, they were more likely to continue watching rather than skipping ahead to the answer. In other words, greater inquisitiveness motivated people to slow down, be patient, and invest in experiencing the winding path to resolution. Although past work has shown that more intense curiosity increases people's motivation to get information, our study found that it also contributes to greater avoidance of early answers. Why do our findings differ from those of other studies? One important factor is what happens while people wait for more details. Watching events unfold over time, as in our animations, may be less uncomfortable than simply wanting a missing answer. Imagine if one of the authors had just stared at the woodpecker while gaining no new information about it. Further, curiosity may feel different when people assume that answers are on the way. When opportunities to seek information abound, curiosity may favor its patient accumulation. But when it seems like waiting will yield limited information, people might prefer immediate resolution. Our experiment also revealed that curiosity was highest at two key points. First, when uncertainty was the greatest, and second, when people were very close to identifying the drawings. To us, this signaled that curiosity seemed to evolve along with the question a person was asking, such as with a shift from an exploratory musing. What could this drawing look like? What could it be? To a more focused query. Is this going to be an Easter egg? The desire for information also seemed to feel different across the journey to resolution. When uncertainty was greatest, curiosity was experienced with joy. But during the second peak, as people got closer to the big reveal, curiosity coincided with frustration, perhaps like the sensation when a word is right on the tip of your tongue. As curiosity evolves over different lines of questioning, the emotional tone may shift from playful happiness to urgent discomfort. So as people watched the video, curiosity would grow, change in emotional timbre, and then decline with resolution. Yet regardless of how curiosity changed, we found that greater curiosity encouraged engagement in the process and led to a greater desire to let a video play out rather than skipping to the answer. Our work underlines the complexity of curiosity, opening new avenues for research to explore its varieties. Thinking about curiosity as going beyond the need for quick answers also highlights the power of what happens when we engage with uncertainty. Having to ponder and anticipate answers can improve learning and memory, and curiosity can facilitate brain states that help us encode new information. Learning new things can be tough, but harnessing curiosity can help us savor the process of learning and delight in overcoming challenges as much as we like working out a whodunit, all in due time. This research project did not address other events that inspire or trigger curiosity. I know when I'm home and I first hear a sound that I can't identify, I'm curious to find the source of the sound, to answer my question of, what is this? It will be interesting to find out if there are other studies that address these situations. But this particular study was conducted by four different investigators. First is Abby Chung, who studied information seeking at Duke University. She is now a researcher at Meta. Zhaohu Po is a postdoctoral researcher at Duke. He studies the cognitive and neural mechanisms supporting learning and memory. Scott Hoidl is a professor of psychology and neuroscience, also at Duke University. He focuses on the behavioral and brain mechanisms of cognition and decision-making. And finally, Allison Adcock is director of the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience and an associate professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Duke. She researches neural mechanisms of motivation and memory. This Mind Matters, No Spoilers, Please. Curiosity makes people hungry for knowledge, but not always in a hurry. Appears in the September 2024 issue of Scientific American. And now the cover story from the latest double issue of Science News, September 7th, September 21st, 2024. Under the radar, squall line tornadoes are sneaky, dangerous, and difficult to forecast, by Nick Ogasa. Meteorologist Thea Sandmael watched the storm close in. It was near enough for her to spot a rotating dome of clouds emerging from its dark underbelly, the quickening of a tornado. By the time the spinning mass was 10 minutes away, Sandmael and her colleagues had packed up their radar equipment and evacuated their post. "Just keep going," she advised her colleague behind the wheel, who was rightly focused on maneuvering their SUV down the remote Alabama road. Evacuating was a good decision. We were sitting on the west side of the road, and the tornado touched down in our exact location. This wasn't just another day of chasing tornadoes for Sandmael of the Cooperative Institute for Severe and High Impact Weather Research and Operations, or CIWRO, in Norman, Oklahoma. On this day, she and her crew were after something unusual, a sneaky type of twister called a squall line tornado. Most tornadoes form in isolated storms called supercells. These tornadoes are the most common, most destructive, and most well-studied class of twisters. Squall-line tornadoes, on the other hand, develop along the front of long rows of storms known as quasi-linear convective systems, or squall lines. They are generally less intense than supercell tornadoes, says atmospheric scientist Karen Kosiba of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. But, she says, this doesn't mean they're not dangerous. Squall-line tornadoes tend to surprise. They are ephemeral and often evade detection, forming and dying in the minutes-long interludes between the scans of most radar systems. They are also difficult to anticipate, manifesting suddenly along rows of storms that can reach hundreds of kilometers long. And compared with supercell tornadoes, squall-line twisters occur more often in cool months, such as during spring and even winter, and in the dark hours of night, when tornadoes are less expected. What's more, squall-line tornadoes are disproportionately more common in the southeastern United States, a region that is particularly vulnerable to twisters. Over the last 70 years, the country's center of tornadic activity, supercell and squall-line alike, has shifted from the Great Plains to the southeast. And that's a concern because the region not only has a denser population than the Great Plains, but it also contains a higher concentration of easily uprooted mobile and manufactured homes. In the country's new tornado heartland, a squall-line twister need not be of great intensity to pose a grave risk. Recognizing the need to reduce that risk, San Mael, Kosiba, and dozens of other researchers joined forces for the Propagation, Evolution, and Rotation in Linear Storms, or PERILS, PERILS, field campaign. During the late winter and spring seasons of 2022 and 2023, teams deployed across the southeast captured an unprecedented trove of data. Their work has already revealed that squall-line tornadoes may be more common and more dangerous than previously thought. Fortunately, researchers may also have discovered clues that could help make these twisters a little less surprising. A tornado recipe with a twist. Whipping up a tornado requires certain atmospheric ingredients, a source of rotation, a lifting mechanism to trigger the rising of air, and something to keep the rising going. Begin with, say, an advancing cold front pushing from underneath to lift the air ahead. This triggers an updraft. To persist, that updraft will need the air near the ground to possess some buoyancy, what meteorologists call instability. And the secret sauce that gets things spinning? That's vertical wind shear, a change in the speed of winds with increasing height. Think of an upright paddle wheel. If higher winds move faster and push harder on the top paddles, the wheel rotates. Recent observations suggest that these ingredients can mix in different ways to create tornadoes in squall lines, says Anthony Liza, an atmospheric scientist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, who works at CIWRO. Take instability, often measured as convective available potential energy, or CAPE, C-A-P-E. CAPE is sometimes described as the amount of fuel available to a growing storm. CAPE values of 1,000 joules per kilogram are usually high enough to power strong storms. But a lot of these squall lines are actually occurring in a low CAPE, high shear environment, says atmospheric scientist Alexandra Anderson Frey of the University of Washington in Seattle. For instance, in March 2022, PERILS researchers measured CAPE of only about 500 joules per kilogram in a squall line over Mississippi and Alabama that produced dozens of tornadoes. Liza says he's seen squall line tornadoes supported by CAPE values as low as 100 joules per kilogram. These low CAPE settings exemplify environments that have been understudied, Anderson Frey says. At the same time, new technology has been uncovering more squall line tornadoes. Unlike older Doppler radar technology, which scans only in the horizontal dimension, newer dual polarization radar scans both the vertical and horizontal dimensions. Over the last decade, the proliferation of the newer tech has increased detections of squall line twisters. All this to say, squall line tornadoes appear to be more common than researchers previously thought. Perhaps then, it is a little less surprising that they may be more dangerous than previously believed, too. There are two photographs. The upper one, squall line tornadoes that hit Mississippi in March 2022, uprooted and destroyed a structure anchored to the ground, and a large swath of trees. Such twisters are disproportionately common in the southeastern United States and during the cool season. Tornadoes inside tornadoes. On a calm afternoon in March 2022, Liza and colleagues showed up at a rural farmstead in Noxubee County, Mississippi. A squall line tornado had torn through the area the day before, and Liza had arrived to help assess the damage for PERILS. And again, PERILS stands for Propagation, Evolution, and Rotation in Linear Storms. Something about the scene struck him as odd. The operational radar hadn't indicated that the tornado had been particularly intense, but Liza observed significant damage to a house on the property. And that was the house referenced by one of the photographs. A good chunk of the roof decking was blown off, and an entire eastern exterior wall was blown out of the house, Liza says. Nearby rested the remains of a machine shed that had been uprooted and ripped apart. The shed had been anchored to the ground by 1.5-meter-long concrete pillars, Liza recalls. We were pretty shocked, he says. We didn't necessarily go to Noxubee County thinking we were going to find strong tornado damage there. The extensive damage wasn't the only surprise. We noticed that the tornado came into the property from the southwest, Liza says. But a trail of damaged trees seemed to suggest that the twister then veered due east for a couple of hundred yards before swerving back toward the northeast. It's not unusual for a tornado to change directions, but at high speeds, their turns become wide, just like cars on a highway. This tornado had been advancing at about 100 kilometers per hour, and yet its track appeared to bend sharply. Fortunately, a mobile radar vehicle had been deployed just 4 kilometers to the south. Its beams had captured the twister's odd dance, along with evidence that its strange path had been shaped by multiple vortices, tornadoes in a tornado. It's a first that I know of, that anyone around here knows of, in terms of a squall line tornado, Liza says. Sub-vortices appeared and disappeared so quickly, their evolution was difficult to follow via the intermittent radar scans. But within a single scan, I think the most I was able to confidently identify was 4 at one time, Liza says. These individual vortices were actually responsible for most of the damage. And the main tornado itself was rather weak. Researchers have observed that squall line tornadoes tend to be wider than supercell tornadoes. Perhaps that's because many house sub-vortices, Liza speculates. Squall line tornadoes also tend to be less effective than supercell twisters at lofting debris into the sky. That could be because sub-vortices are so short-lived that they won't necessarily have the opportunity to lift debris as high up, Liza says. Sub-vortices probably increase the maximum intensity of the tornado, says wind engineer Frank Lombardo of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, who assessed the damage at the site with Liza. The wind speed in a sub-vortex may compound with the wind speed of the parent tornado. It's hard to say whether sub-vortices are common in squall-line tornadoes based on a single case, But if they are, we might have to revisit our tornado risk calculations, Lombardo adds. We may have totally underestimated their intensity. Improving twister forecasts. The discovery that squall-line tornadoes may be more common and fiercer than previously thought makes predicting them even more urgent. Thankfully, perils atmospheric scientist Todd Murphy of the University of Louisiana Monroe and his colleagues may have found some much-needed clues. Researchers believe that peculiar wind patterns within squall lines might help them predict twisters. They're essentially interested in gyres of wind called mesovortices, which can range in diameter from less than a kilometer to dozens of kilometers. Mesovortices often develop in places where advancing squall lines develop bulges in the shape of an archer's bow. For decades, scientists have observed that tornadoes often formed within these bows. We can predict squall lines well, generally with more accuracy than we can predict other types of thunderstorms, said atmospheric scientist Patrick Skinner of CIWRO. But forecasting the embedded mesovortices is very difficult, he says. What's more, only some mesovortices form tornadoes, and researchers don't know why that's the case. During the Perils Field campaign, Murphy and his team used light detection and ranging, or LIDAR, instruments to monitor the atmosphere in the hours before a squall line's arrival. These instruments scan the skies with pencil-thin laser beams, which reflect off aerosols that act as tracers for the wind. In the vast majority of our cases, the LIDAR data showed pretty abrupt changes in the wind profile, beginning about 90 minutes before the squall line got to the site, Murphy says. At different levels of the lower atmosphere, the vertical wind shear grew larger, inducing more rotation within the squall line. It wasn't just the wind shear that changed dramatically. All of the perils' key ingredients for tornado formation can change really rapidly within an hour or two ahead of the arrival of a squall line, Liza says. Using data collected during perils, along with about 10 years' worth of radar data gathered jointly by the National Weather Service, the Federal Aviation Administration, and the U.S. Air Force, Murphy and colleagues analyzed wind velocities at different levels of the atmosphere, ahead of mesovortices that formed tornadoes and those that did not. Ahead of tornadic mesovortices, there appeared to be slightly more wind shear, Murphy says. More importantly, there was more rotation, and this signature was more pronounced ahead of squall lines that generated at least five twisters. Along the length of a squall line, mesovortices swirl within updrafts that continually form and dissipate. Ahead of the tornadic mesovortices, these updrafts may align with air circulating near the ground. When this occurs, the updraft may pull the circulation upward, narrowing its diameter like dough stretched thin, causing it to spin faster. We call it the ice skater effect, Murphy says, referencing the famous example of a skater spinning faster when both arms are pulled close to the body. If you stretch that rotation, he says, it causes the radius to get smaller, but the rotation strengthens. If meteorologists are monitoring conditions 60 to 90 minutes ahead of a squall line, and the wind profile starts to develop this pronounced signature of wind shear and rotation, then they may need to consider issuing warnings, Murphy says. He hopes that vetting by other researchers will prove the signal's worth as a reliable risk indicator. If all goes well, that could happen sometime in the next couple of years, he says. Meanwhile, other projects that could improve forecasts are also in the works. Skinner works on NOAA's Warn On Forecast, a project to increase the lead time of forecasts for tornadoes and other severe weather. He'll be using the perils data to determine how much resolution current weather simulations need to accurately portray mesovortices in squall lines. It's going to take vast improvements in our weather simulations to be able to predict squall line tornadoes as well as we can predict supercell tornadoes, Murphy says. But eventually, he says, I think we'll get there. And under the radar is the cover feature in the latest issue of Science News, the September 7th, 21st double issue. Squall line tornadoes are sneaky, dangerous, and difficult to forecast, writes Nick Ogasa. Next, our first of two New York Times trilobites. The first, things are looking up for Africa's upside-down baobab trees. A researcher followed up on a study warning that the massive trees were in danger and found many venerable specimens thriving. By Rachel Neuer, who has reported on earlier concerns about baobabs, as well as the tree's evolutionary origins. Baobabs are arboreal icons that have punctuated Africa's landscapes for around 12 million years. With crowns that can grow as large as three tennis courts, they are important for more than their role in ecosystems. The trees are featured in cultural traditions across Africa, and they also support the livelihoods of thousands of people who harvest baobab fruit. And across mainland Africa, a researcher has argued recently, the trees are flourishing. This finding offers a contrast with reports several years ago that Adansonia digitata, a baobab species that is widespread, was in serious jeopardy in the face of droughts and rising temperatures linked to climate change, with some of the largest baobabs collapsing in on themselves. In 2018, researchers took note of the tree's troubles in the journal Nature Plants. This alarming news caught the attention of Sarah Venter, a baobab ecologist at the University of the Witwatersrand in South Africa. She had not seen signs in her own fieldwork that the continent's ancient baobabs were in trouble, so she decided to conduct her own investigation, which was also published earlier this year in the journal Nature Plants. Dr. Venter found that just five of the trees flagged in the 2018 paper had actually died, while the other 10 were healthy or regrowing. An additional 13 exceptionally large baobabs that Dr. Venter had visited in southern Africa also appeared to be doing well. In a review of recently published literature, Dr. Venter showed that millions of baobabs populate the continent, including in areas that have endured severe droughts or floods. Six species of baobabs in Madagascar are imperiled by deforestation. These findings suggest that there's a very healthy population of baobabs across Africa, she said. There is a photograph of the Glencoe baobab in Hoedspruit, South Africa, taken in 2018. It split in 2009 into several stout parts, low to the ground. The photograph was taken by Sarah Venter. The next photo, one she also took, shows regrowth in 2023 of the Platland tree in South Africa, which collapsed in 2016. Dr. Venter traveled around southern Africa to survey the health of adult baobab trees of all sizes. She found a normal distribution of individuals and no signs of out-of-the-ordinary disease or mortality. In one group of 116 trees that Dr. Venter has monitored since 1998, for example, none of the adults have died in the past 26 years, despite numerous droughts. She also visited most of the exceptionally old and large trees included in the 2018 study. For the five trees that perished, she found that only one death seemed to be linked to drought. The other four baobabs appeared to have died randomly during periods of normal rainfall and temperature. Without being at the trees during time of death, the exact cause cannot be said for certain, she said. Most likely, though, their large, heavy limbs had fallen off and the breaks had become infected, she said. Of five trees in the 2018 study reported to have collapsed, Dr. Venter found that four were growing back. This was not a surprise, she said, because it's part of baobab ecology to collapse and grow out again from the stems that are left. Drought driven by climate change did not seem to have contributed to these trees' collapse either, she added. Jens Gebauer, a horticulturist at the Rheinwald University of Applied Sciences in Germany, who was not involved in the research, agreed with her conclusion that climate change is not the main cause for some of the old baobabs dying. In general, the baobab is a very climate-resilient plant species, Dr. Gebauer said. But things could change in the future, he added, because the baobab cannot deal with excessive moisture caused either by climate change or human activities. Carl von Reden, an oceanographer at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and an author of the 2018 study, said the new paper's findings that the trees had collapsed because of structural failure sounds reasonable. He added, though, that the study does not contradict the assumption that climate change is one of the important drivers of the observed effects. Why did baobabs stand tall for hundreds to thousands of years to fall in a relatively short period, Dr. von Reden said. The authors correctly assert that more surveys are necessary. Dr. Venter maintained that climate change did not seem to be a major factor in baobab death and collapse. If it was, she said, then other large baobabs would also show signs of stress. But that's not what I saw. Baobabs do face other threats, she added. Saplings struggle to survive in areas with high levels of livestock grazing. Trees growing in places with high density of elephants can also be imperiled, because when they face food shortages, the elephants will eat baobabs. Dr. Venter stressed that for now, though, there is no reason to fear that mainland Africa's baobabs will disappear. It's just such an incredibly resilient tree, Dr. Venter said. I think they've got a great future. This trilobite, Things Are Looking Up for Africa's Upside-Down Baobab Trees, was posted on September 27, 2024. Our second trilobite is entitled, Why Mount Everest is Growing Taller Every Year. Researchers say that two rivers merged some 89,000 years ago and gave the mightiest peak in the Himalayas a huge growth spurt. By Robin George Andrews. Mount Everest is many things. It's called Chomolungma in Tibetan and Sagarmatha in Nepali. It's an iconic part of Earth's topography, a potentially lethal climbing challenge, and a geologic marvel. It's also staggeringly tall, and with a peak 29,032 feet above sea level, it easily achieves the status of the world's tallest mountain by about 800 feet over other Himalayan peaks like K2, Kangchenjunga, and Lhotse. But what gave Everest its height advantage and contributes to making it grow taller by millimeters every year? Research published on Monday, September 30th, in the journal Nature Geoscience, points to a surprising cause. A river stolen long ago by another marauding waterway. Rivers are agents of erosion, but their consumption of land can have unexpected effects. About 89,000 years ago, a powerful river annexed another one nearby. Combined, the two grew more erosive. This led to the washing away of far more of the Himalayan landscape, and a huge weight was shorn from the crust, the layer of earth we live on. This lightweight crust, the study says, was able to float more easily atop the underlying mantle layer. Ultimately, this has added anywhere from 50 to 165 feet to the height of Everest, serving as a reminder that nothing, not even a colossal pyramid of rock, is immutable. Although mountains may appear to stand still from the perspective of a human lifetime, they are in fact constantly in motion, said Jingen Dai, a geoscientist at the China University of Geosciences in Beijing, who is an author of the study. Although this explanation can account only for part of Everest's additional height, scientists see it as a step toward accounting for how the mountain grew to what it now is. It's a really neat story, and one that makes a lot of sense, said Tom Gernon, a geoscientist at the University of Southampton in England, who was not involved with the new work. Everest began to form around 45 million years ago, when the tectonic plate India rests on crashed into the Eurasian plate, and then started descending below it. The crust buckled and crumpled on a gargantuan scale, creating the Himalayas. Earth's crust may seem rigid, but it's not. When something massive like an ice sheet or a mountain range weighs down the crust, it flexes downward. But the mantle below is buoyant, nudging the sagging crust upward. It's as if the Himalayas are standing on a bouncy castle, said Adam Smith, a geoscientist at University College London in England, who is an author of the new study. When the crust neither rises nor sinks, it's referred to as being in isostatic equilibrium. And Everest should be in that stage. Material is always being scraped off the Indian plate and added to the mountain range as the plate plunges downward. Rock is also being removed from the mountain's exposed surfaces by precipitation and the grinding movement of glaciers. These forces should balance each other, and Everest should neither shrink nor grow. But Everest's superlative height suggests that something had been putting its thumb on the tectonic scales, and there is nothing better at creating that imbalance than a rock-eating river. In Everest's shadow lies the Aran River, and just as Everest outgrew the other Himalayan peaks, the Aran distinguishes itself from neighboring waterways. The Aran takes a suspiciously circuitous route. It runs along the northern Himalayas and then turns abruptly and cuts through a ridge near Everest. That suggests the upper and lower segments of the river were not always unified, and that something significant forced them to become one. Reproducing the region's myriad rivers in computer simulations, the researchers identified that big moment. Some 89,000 years ago, a river network, the Kosi, cut backward into the Himalayas and eventually reached the Aran, plundering its water and merging with it. The Himalayas were no match for this rock-eroding liquid behemoth. The gossamer crust was pushed skyward by the buoyant mantle sea, various peaks were uplifted, and Everest gained up to 165 extra feet in the blink of a geologic eye. The tallest mountain on Earth is still growing, by about the width of a strand of spaghetti each year. A combination of factors, including this crustal rebound, explains these gains. But its growth spurt probably won't continue forever. The balance could tip the other way, shaving some of Everest's great height. The Himalayas will rise and fall, as all mountain ranges do. The rocky skin of a dynamic planet is never stationary. On long timescales, Mr. Smith said, it's almost as if the Earth is breathing. And this New York Times trilobite, Why Mount Everest is Growing Taller Every Year, was posted on September 30th, 2024, and written by Robin George Andrews. We end with a book review. In Science News, the September 7th, September 21st double issue from Bookshelf, a new book tackles AI hype. The book being reviewed is AI Snake Oil, published by Princeton University. The review written by Elizabeth Quill. A few months ago, I was working on an article about oceans across the solar system. Having read my fill about oceans of water, I turned to Google for a quick refresher on oceans made of other stuff, liquid hydrocarbons, for example. For better or worse, I searched oceans in the solar system, not water. I sought a reliable link, maybe from NASA. Instead, Google's AI Overviews feature served up Enceladus as one suggestion. This Saturn moon is famous for its subsurface sea of salt water. I shut my laptop in frustration. That's one small example of how AI fails. Arvind Narayanan and Sayash Kapoor collect dozens of others in their new book, AI Snake Oil, many with consequences far more concerning than irking one science journalist. They write about AI tools that purport to predict academic success, the likelihood someone will commit a crime, disease risk, civil wars, and welfare fraud. Along the way, the authors weave in many other issues with AI, covering misinformation, a lack of consent for images, and other training data, false copyright claims, deepfakes, privacy, and the reinforcement of social inequities. They address whether we should be afraid of AI, concluding, "We should be far more concerned about what people will do with AI than with what AI will do on its own." The authors acknowledge that the technology is advancing quickly. Some of the details may be out of date, or at least old news, by the time the book makes it into your hands. And clear discussions about AI must contend with a lack of consensus over how to define key terms, including the meaning of AI itself. Still, Narayanan and Kapoor squarely achieve their stated goal, to empower people to distinguish AI that works well from AI snake oil, which they define as AI that does not and cannot work as advertised. Narayanan is a computer scientist at Princeton University, and Kapoor is a PhD student there. The idea for the book was conceived when slides for a talk that Narayanan gave in 2019, titled "How to Recognize AI Snake Oil," went viral. He teamed up with Kapoor, who was taking a course that Narayanan was teaching with another professor on the limits of prediction in social settings. The authors take direct aim at AI that can allegedly predict future events. "It is in this arena that most AI snake oil is concentrated," they write. "Predictive AI not only does not work today, but will never work because of the inherent difficulties in predicting human behavior." They also devote a long chapter to the reasons AI cannot solve social media's content moderation woes. Kapoor had worked at Facebook, helping to create AI for content moderation. One challenge is that AI struggles with context and nuance. Social media also tends to encourage hateful and dangerous content. The authors are a bit more generous with generative AI, recognizing its value if used smartly. But in a section titled "Automating Bullshit," the authors note, "ChatGPT is shockingly good at sounding convincing on any conceivable topic, but there is no source of truth during training. It's not just that the training data can contain falsehoods, the data are mostly internet text after all, but also that the program is optimized to sound natural, not necessarily to possess or verify knowledge." That explains Enceladus. I'd add that an overreliance on generative AI can discourage critical thinking, the human quality at the very heart of this book. When it comes to why these problems exist and how to change them, Narayanan and Kapoor bring a clear point of view. Society has been too deferential to the tech industry. Better regulation is essential. We are not okay with leaving the future of AI up to the people currently in charge, they write. This book is a worthwhile read, whether you make policy decisions, use AI in the workplace, or just spend time searching online. It's a powerful reminder of how AI has already infiltrated our lives, and a convincing plea to take care in how we interact with it. This bookshelf review, A New Book Tackles AI Hype, reviews AI Snake Oil, published by Princeton University and written by Arvind Narayanan and Sayash Kapoor. Other reviews in brief: Dinosaurs at the Dinner Party by Edward Dalnick. This book introduces the eccentric characters of the Victorian era, whose early discoveries of dinosaur fossils drastically transformed our understanding of the natural world. Published by Scribner. In the Land of Ninkazi by Tate Paulette. An archaeologist takes a trip back to the cradle of civilization to recount the beer-drinking habits of people living in ancient Mesopotamia. Published by Oxford University. Love Triangle, written by Matt Parker. A stand-up comedian and math writer showcases all the ways triangles come into play in our everyday lives, weaving in the stories of history's most daring mathematicians and thinkers along the way. Published by Riverhead Books. And The Secret Life of the Universe, written by Natalie A. Cabral. An astrobiologist guides readers on a journey through the cosmos to investigate the likeliest places where life could be hiding. Published by Scribner. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening this afternoon, and please join me again next Sunday.